Hello and welcome to Servcast from Studio 22, where students are challenged to serve, learn, and grow in their communities through the love of Jesus Christ. Now here are your hosts, William and Christian.
Welcome back to Servcast. We're glad you joined us today. I'm William Lamb. I'm your host, and today's topic is on human trafficking. I normally would not introduce the topic like this, but I need you to understand this conversation that's going to take place in the next two segments. Our guest today is Dr. Bob Rogers, who is the president and CEO of Street Grace out of Atlanta, Georgia. He was recently in the Lee University Chapel, and this is a follow-up conversation after his talk in the chapel. So some of the questions that you're going to be hearing today are coming from students' responses that were in the audience. They sent those questions to me, and I'm asking those of Bob so he can help us to better understand this horrible, horrible issue of human trafficking in our world that we normally probably would prefer to forget that it even exists. So join us, listen, we'll go straight into that interview. Welcome to Servcast. I need to give you a disclaimer today. My throat is a little raspy. So this isn't normally how I talk, but you know, long story short, hey, just endure it because I'm not really going to be the one talking that much. Dr. Bob Rogers is going to be the one talking a lot. Hey, Bob, how you doing? Welcome to Servcast. We're glad you're here.
Thanks so much. Delighted to be here.
So Bob, you're a Lee alum. You're a president of a organization we're going to unpack in a little bit. You're a past seminary college president or something like that, or
yes,
I don't know. But anyway, your claim to fame is you're the dad of three awesome kids, right?
That's right. That's right.
So we got Corey, we got Taylor, and we got Bobby, right?
That's right.
Now I was their favorite professor. Is that true? Or
that
not?
Is my recollection of it exactly. And the and not to be forgot, the best thing I took away from the Lee campus was Melinda, my wife. We've
there
been married
go.
For just over 30 years.
There you go. Yeah, we like Melinda as well. So, man, we are delighted you took some time out to join us today. Now your chapel talk is going to be available in the show notes. So anybody that wants to be able to listen to the entire chapel talk will be able to do that. So we're not necessarily trying to reiterate that talk. We do have some questions, direct questions that came into us from students, and we'll kind of unpack those in just a little bit. But tell us what you're doing now and what is Street Grace for those persons who are not in chapel, who might not get a chance to actually listen to the talk. What is Street Grace? What are you doing? You know, who is this organization and why?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. Delighted to be here and excited to be talking with you. Street Grace is an organization. We're based out of Atlanta, Georgia. We were birthed in the faith community, a coalition of a number of churches that came together in response to the growing issue of sex trafficking in the Atlanta metropolitan area, specifically the growing issue surrounding domestic minor sex trafficking, or what is often referred to as the commercial sexual exploitation of children. And that would be anyone under the age of 18. So Street Grace is an organization that focuses on ending the demand. So we work on education, training, awareness, prevention with primarily youth, middle schoolers, and at the university level. And then we do an awful lot of public and community type work. We don't do the restorative care. There are a number of organizations in Atlanta that do that very well. One of them even, in fact, is also a Lee alum, Bruce Deal, who founded the City of Refuge, that does a fantastic job and that we partner with them for our rescue and restorative type care. And then we leap over all of that and we pursue those who would traffic individuals and those who would be buyers of sex. So that's the way that we approach the issue, primarily focusing on how to end the demand.
In your talk, you made this statement or something close to it. You mentioned that the culture, by and large, doesn't handle sexuality carefully anymore like we should. We see that as obviously a contributor to a lot of the problems that's happening. So what is the appropriate way to view this idea of sexuality that is so ingrained in our culture and saturated us in so many ways?
Wow, that is a big question. So way to lead with the softball. I think the way that I would answer that is that I would come back and say, in our current culture and in society, there is very little that we handle gently anymore. There's very little that we handle carefully. Sex is often viewed as just something that's available to us, whether we're in a marriage, whether we're not in marriage, however we want to do it. It's often viewed as something that's a personal choice that doesn't impact other people. It's also viewed as an issue oftentimes and has no consequences. And I think the issue for us there is to kind of have a theology of sex, and that is determine how do we view sex in light of the fact that, and hopefully this isn't a news-breaking statement, but God loves sex.
Sure.
God created sex, and sex is not a benefit of marriage. Sex is a gift from mm-hmm. God. And so how we handle that, how we use that, and the delicacy with which we manage it, view others, and handle those type of situations, I think is critically important. And we're living in a society where it's just not in the norm, and it's not even politically correct almost anymore to talk about sexual things in a way that would guard and protect them when we're primarily swimming upstream or fighting this issue of it's anything and it's a free-for-all and whatever you want is yours and it's your right to have it.
So where should that begin? I mean, you're an advocacy group in a lot of ways. You're a hands-on group in a lot of ways. But where does this reclaiming of the purity that God intended? By the way, if you're not catching it, Bob is unashamedly faith-based, okay? Unashamedly a believer in Christ, and it frames what you do.
Correct.
So what are some steps to getting this back?
I think there's two. I think there's one is how do we address the current culture and how do we address where we are now? And one of those is some of what we talked about today and some of what we talk about in every talk that we give, and that is giving folks permission to view this differently and giving folks permission to stand up and say, this is how I believe and this is how I feel. Secondly, there's this issue of taking it back in the home. We have a phrase that we use. It's not anything other than catchy, and that is 8 is too late. If you're not talking to your kids by the time they're 8 about sex and sexual-related issues, how we view them as Christians, how we view them in the light of God's Word, and how we view them given that they are a gift from God and not just something that's available for our use, then you're starting too late because the culture outside of the home is beginning to shape. The sad fact is the vast majority of kids inside and outside of the church are learning about sexual things through pornography. The facts are there. It's uncontested. And that is occurring inside and outside of the church. My generation and other generations have remained so silent on these issues because we felt like they weren't appropriate to talk about publicly. They weren't appropriate to talk about in group settings. And they were uncomfortable to talk about even in the home. And as a result of that, there's been a shifting of just public information and this advent of the internet that makes all of this information available in a very distorted view. But because there's no opposing voice, it's become normalized.
So this whole idea then that accessibility often, is part of the problem. People have accessibility to endless interest of their own sexual failures and their appetites that are obviously, anti-biblical and not what God intended. So how do we be bold? How does someone actually, be bold enough to turn off this kind of material or to deal with this issue, whether it's voluntary or involuntary, meaning that they came up on it or maybe they were actually participating in some activity that decided, wait a minute, hey, I know I'm going down the wrong road. How do you become bold in this attempt to, as an individual, how do they become bold in this attempt to actually say, I got to put a stop to this today, right now?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of real practical ways, and that's the easiest way for me to look at it. I don't think anybody, for the most part, we don't need heroes. For the most part, what we need is people that will behave properly and people that will formulate their own decisions and then have the courage to stand their ground and to act upon them. What we need is more people that are willing to have the conversation. And the fact that we haven't had the conversation and we've had generations that have remained silent, it's allowed this thing to kind of fester to the point now that it's an epidemic. So quite frankly, this is a big step. Just having the conversation at Lee today in chapel is a big step. We're invited in and are speaking almost every Sunday on a Sunday morning service in a pulpit somewhere about these issues. So the church is recognizing the issue. The church is drawing the information out, and the church is beginning to take a clear and necessary stand. But I think the biggest issue for us is we look at the magnitude of it. I mean, if I'm sitting here with you today and we're talking about taking on the issue of pornography or sexual exploitation or sex trafficking, the statistics and the information are so overwhelming that I think it's easy to feel like you can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And the truth is we can. It starts in our home. It starts in our dorm room. It starts at our place of business. We're working with businesses that are instituting policies on expense management and travel expenses and internet policies. It's been an issue that's just been a difficult thing to walk into. But as people are having the conversation, it's normalizing. It's normalizing the fact that it is appropriate for us to talk about these things and determine what's appropriate. And that's an exciting thing for me. And that's an exciting thing that we're seeing. That of all of the work that we're doing right now, and we're doing a lot, by the end of this week, we will have spoken to 65,000-66,000 people already this year. That's the most exciting piece of what we're doing. We're talking to teenagers and we're talking to middle schoolers, and they know there's a problem and they know there's a lack of direction, and they are so open to receiving the information and the input, and they want to know what to do.
So is Street Grace more of a kind of a going on awareness advocacy group, or do you actually go out into the street and, you know, interact with people who are involved, both victims and traffickers, and try to actually alleviate this from ground level?
The answer would be both.
Okay.
We do advocacy, awareness, education, and training. We do that in all levels. We do it to law enforcement, with community groups, churches. We also have what we call street teams that meet on Saturdays, and those are 100% of those are partnered with local churches in the communities that we go to serve, and then we go out and we knock on the doors of hotels and places that we know from criminal records, from criminal arrest, and from police records are highly areas that are highly susceptible to trafficking and trafficking-related issues. Now, every door that's opened, behind it isn't a trafficking victim, but every door that's opened, there's something there that we can minister to, and there's someone there that we can talk to. So we are out in street teams, and we are carrying the message of hope and the gospel of Jesus Christ, because it is relevant to all of the issues.
So why is human trafficking such a difficult issue to deal to kind of fight? You know, I mean, if everyone knows that human trafficking is wrong, or if the police know that human trafficking is wrong, you know, why can't they just go in and have these stings and arrest all these people? I mean, what's the steps to get this thing turned around?
No, I think it's a good question, and it's an easy question. It's a difficult question. The easy part of it is it's a numbers game and it's a math. You can follow the money. Human trafficking on a broader scale is $150 billion a year illegal
Say
business.
That again. Hold on.
$150 billion with a B, dollar illegal business. It's the second largest and the fastest growing illegal business in the world, second only to drug trafficking. But in that arena, we combat that with the combined efforts of the United Nations, all of the governments and the NGOs around the world. We fight that $150 billion business with less than $500 million in donations. And so you look at the math right there, and it's a little lopsided at best. So I think a lot of it is just this perspective of we can do something about it if we all come together. But the biggest issue we've been facing is denial. It's been really difficult for folks to believe that this occurs in their neighborhoods, in their communities. It's been very difficult for folks to believe that this can occur at their churches, at their places of where they go to work, where they go to shop, and to believe that it could happen here. They always think it's a their problem, and it's not. It's a here problem. The vast majority of victims of sex trafficking are trafficked from the U.S., in the U.S., and bought and sold by people in our communities.
And see, we look at it as a non-U.S., you know, another world,
right,
without labeling any particular, you know, group of folks, another world kind of a problem. But you're saying this is really largely stemmed here.
Oh, yeah. It is pervasive globally. But it is not a situation where we need to look elsewhere to address the problem. Mm-hmm. Every community that you and I are talking to or talking about or that we visit, every community that we visit, there's a human trafficking problem there.
So small town, large town.
Absolutely.
You know, south, west, east, north, anywhere, everywhere.
Absolutely.
Now, we haven't always been able to talk about this kind of with, you know, in a welcoming kind of an atmosphere. When did this turn? How long ago did this proactive approach really turn to where we can begin to now become more awareness-based versus let's just go in and deal with the issue in the way we know? You know, let's now become more aware of this. When did this shift for us as a culture?
slowly it began to occur in the 80s and the 90s. In 2000, there was federal law that was passed, the Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act, that began to address it and began to elevate the visibility of the issue. Since that time, that legislation at a federal level has been revised, I think, 4 or 5 times. As that has occurred, a number of states have gotten involved and have begun to take the issue head on. Primarily because someone in a state will take it on as an issue and they'll begin to say, you know, for so long we've looked at these victims of sex trafficking and human trafficking as it's their fault. Wrong place, wrong time, bad decisions. That's not the case at all. It's like this idea of prostitution. Very, very difficult to process and understand that prostitution might occur. These are victims of human trafficking. These are folks who have been bought and sold. Even if that's not the current case, many of them, it's the only trade that they know, and so they're trapped in it themselves. It's survival sex. It's for food, for money, for living needs and things like that. So, I mean, it's an issue that has become more and more prevalent. And the churches now, over the last 8 to 10 years, the church has begun to rise up, here in America especially, and begin to take this issue on head on. And as they do that, and as the church and legislation and law enforcement and government agencies and not-for-profits and the educational community all begin to come together, we're starting to see the tide shift. We've got a long road ahead of us, but I'm very encouraged about what's happening and the collective group of people that are beginning to come together around the issue.
Collaboration works.
Absolutely.
Care works. Compassion works.
Yeah.
And we're going to be right back to continue this conversation with our friend Bob. Welcome back to Surfcast. We're continuing this conversation with our friend Bob Rogers regarding this whole idea of human trafficking. So, Bob, in the last segment, we talked a little bit about, you know, the culture and kind of the reality of what's happening and numbers and locations and types. These are people.
Yeah.
Created by the same God that created you and I.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Both the offender and the offended.
Mm-hmm.
The victim and the trafficker, right? They're all people.
Yeah.
So what is your organization doing? Are you caring for one particular group of this issue, or are you dealing with both sides of the house?
Great question. It's an interesting conversation, and quite frankly, it's a difficult one, especially when we first get up and begin to unpack it. One of the things that we've been addressing, I guess intentionally, the last 12 months or so, is that if we are a Christ-centered organization, and if we do believe that Christ is attempting to redeem all things back to Him at all times and all circumstances, then why do we, not why, how do we approach this when it comes to the survivors or the victims, the buyers of sex, and the traffickers? Because the truth is, our ultimate goal should be to see all three of them in heaven. And that's a really difficult concept for folks to wrap their head around initially. And I always want to say very clearly that that in no way indicates that we're soft on legislation, that we're soft on consequences, that we're soft on penalties. We're not. We've led the state's anti-sex trafficking lobby day for the last 9 years. We helped craft and have been a part of a number of legislative agenda items that have passed in Georgia and some of the other states throughout. What it does mean is that we acknowledge that sending someone to prison for sexually deviant behavior is an appropriate consequence, but it is not usually the solution and the cure for sexually deviant behavior. In addition to that, we know statistically, just again, very practically, 7 to 8% of the people who purchase sex account for over 50% of the transactions. So you have your high volume, high frequency users. There are so many numbers and there's so many different ways that this equation points to that if we want to truly end the demand for sex trafficking, we have to approach this from a three-pronged approach. And so, again, on the education side, teaching young people, youth, teens, middle schools, high schools, how to address, how to identify it, how to talk about it, how to report it. And candidly, how to address or how to understand that in every group we talk to, statistically speaking, and statistics are misleading sometimes because they are humans.
Mm-hmm.
But statistically speaking, every group we talk to, there's almost always someone there who has been caught up in some way, shape, or form with trafficking or sexual exploitation. And so taking that and then carrying that same message of what? Hope, healing, and restoration to a buyer of sex and to a trafficker. And so we've added some programming and we've added some other initiatives and we've begun to partner with some other folks that will allow us to take a more comprehensive approach to that. We haven't perfected it yet because there's not a lot of folks out there that are viewing it from that way. Most of the organizations that are out there are looking to protect the victims and the survivors. Mm-hmm. Very appropriate. But to take it to the next step and look at the traffickers and the buyers of sex is something that we're beginning to get into and beginning to lay some groundwork. And some of that will be outreach ministries into jail and into prison. Some of it is the street teams that I mentioned earlier in the last segment where we're out and about and we're talking. We will knock on a door and you are just as likely to have a victim or a survivor of sex trafficking open the door as you are a trafficker. And you are just as likely for the trafficker to ask you to pray with them as you would a victim of sex trafficking. So it's a very interesting dynamic and it's a door that's open and there's so much trauma, turmoil, and mess that's just wrapped up in this whole thing, that there are opportunities for ministry and opportunities for light to pierce through in all of the categories.
You know, I think most of us have been in some environment somewhere, in some store, walking down the street, and we saw some particular activity that didn't seem right.
Yeah.
You know, how do you identify if it's really genuinely a potential sex trafficking issue? You know, how do you really look at something from a distance and hone in on that and say, wait a minute, you know, my gut says something isn't right. Maybe my discernment, you know, maybe my relationship with God's indicating this isn't right. How do we filter through that? You know, what does it actually look like at that level?
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was a child and was growing up, I knew where the monsters were, okay? They were under the bed, they were in the closet, and they were in the basement of the Phillips house where I would babysit. Now we don't. And that's a really difficult and challenging thing. If you want to know what a victim of trafficking looks like, if you want to know what a buyer of sex or a trafficker looks like, almost anywhere you are, you can look to your left and your right. And I don't say that tongue in cheek. It's the difficulty and it's the biggest challenge, this cloak of anonymity that has for so long been associated with this, especially for the buyers of sex. They're the ones that, for the most part, until now, have been able to get off from scot-free. I mean, the victim who has been prostituted or trafficked gets arrested. The trafficker's not on scene, and the buyer has oftentimes in the past been slapped on the hand and told him to get out of there and get home to dinner. Mm-hmm. So there's this awareness issue that allows us to be able to see it from a law enforcement standpoint. They can see it more clearly because of training and legislation. On the other side of things, I think the biggest challenge that we face is just talking about it and just knowing that people are out there. You can look internally. I mean, you can look at your house. You can look at your friends and your families. If you're looking at kids, have they got another cell phone? Have they got a new cell phone? Has there been a change in study habits? Has there been a change in grades? Now, some of those things and a lot of those things just sound like teenagers. So you have to be attentive to it. But if there have been, you know, new tattoos, provocative clothing that's changed, a friend group that's changed dramatically, are you monitoring and paying attention to the social media activity of your kids? That's something that parents feel very awkward about anymore, but it's critical. It's the number one recruiting ground right now for victims of sex trafficking, is that the traffickers are looking online through social media and recruiting and building relationships under false pretenses. So I think you look at all of that and you just ask yourself the question, does this look normal? Does this look okay? And if it doesn't, you know how to report it.
Mm-hmm. So if I see somebody in a store and I'm thinking, these two people shopping together doesn't look right, you know, what do I do?
Yeah, I think you assess the situation. You listen to the thing in your gut that's telling you what to do. If you feel like there's imminent danger or something seems grossly out of the ordinary, you call 911. Otherwise, there's a human trafficking hotline, and it's 888-3737-888. That's 888-3737-888. Everybody should have that programmed in their phone. It's the least that all of us could do.
So I know you're working in what would seemingly be a very dangerous environment in a lot of ways, you know, and especially when you're rescuing or restoring, perhaps, you know, a victim. But let's shift for just a minute, because I think you touched on something that we as a society aren't really accustomed to doing, and that's caring for the offender.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want to, you know, be kind of inconsiderate of the reality that, you know, that there's a lot of folks, unfortunately, that have been victims and have been done wrong, you know, by any number of people. But if we can do your third initiative, which is somehow in the demand, and deal with the traffickers. So in dealing with the traffickers, what is it like to interact with them? And, you know, how can they do something that would appear so evil and sometimes be so apparently caring about that?
Yeah, it's what we've done is that we've normalized taking a human life and devaluing it as if it's just a commodity or it's just a widget, and that we can buy and sell it for our own gain and for our own purpose. At the end of the day, it all follows the money trail. And so if you truly want to address demand, which we do, the way that we go after that is that if we can shut down the buying process, the ability to conduct the transaction, that's what it all hinges on. If the transaction goes away, the trafficker goes away. If the transaction goes away, the victim of sex trafficking, the person that's being bought and sold, those issues go away. And the single largest thing that's had for the last, well, to date, has been anonymity. The buyers of sex have been able to hide behind a computer screen, have been not prosecuted when they've been arrested or when the stings have occurred, and that's beginning to shift. There are organizations now that will put your face on a billboard. Mm-hmm. There are organizations and there are websites now that will list your face so that if you've been arrested for pimping and pandering and those type buying sex related issues, you are publicly shamed. There are organizations that will send a letter to your home to make sure that your family members and your place mm-hmm. of employment knows. We don't go that far in all of that. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. That's just not our calling.
Sure, sure.
But what we do is that we try to go and reach to those folks. And the program that we do allows us to have interaction with buyers of sex. I meet with men. I meet with primarily men, but men and women who have been buyers of sex on a regular basis. And what we hear from them is this sense of isolation. Many of them themselves experienced sexual trauma as a child. Or have unresolved trauma that has been in their life. And so this is an acting out. I'm not justifying it in any way, shape, or form. But the folks that have been on that side of the table have also somewhere along the way, in many, many cases, been victimized themselves. Mm-hmm. And so you have this whole concoction of multiple complex trauma occurring at all levels. And the only way that we know to resolve it is to step into it, to speak truth to it, and to act decisively. And so our programming does that, and that it offers solutions and opportunities to get help for all of the people that are involved in it.
So the average person, not a PhD, yeah. not a doctor, not a past college president, not a well-known name, the average person in restorative care, How do we get engaged in this process of restorative care? I know we've talked about ways that you can identify and what you should do in an immediate response, but let's just say that there's someone out here that loves people so much that they want to be a rescue place. They want to be somebody that, you know, is vetted and trusted and proven and you know it's a safe place. You know, how can people who really want to help both the victim and help the offender to be restored? What are some steps for them in this process to get there?
The great question. The single greatest thing that anyone could do that wants to get involved in the movement or the work of the healing and the restoration would be to reach out to us, and we can help connect you with people in your organization. Google organizations in your area. Reach out to a church or an organization, a Rotary Club that you know. Rotary is very involved in it globally. And get plugged in with an organization where you can volunteer. Get plugged in with an organization where you can commit your time, your resources, and your finances to. And get involved and do the work. And then see where that leads. Too many times folks hear something, they see something, and their next step is they've immediately been called to build a house, open more beds, and start a program. Yeah. And about 99% of those never get through to completion because there's so much involved in that process, and there's so many regulations that go over that are involved with creating the appropriate care of therapeutic, the appropriate type of therapeutic care environment and residential care. Find an organization in your community. One exists. I mean, there's an organization that is probably within 30 minutes of everybody anywhere that would hear something about this. Mm-hmm. And get involved, get to help, and then see where you begin to find your passions and your heart and your finances line up, and then grow into that. That's what organizations need. That's what we need. That's what every other not-for-profit out there that I'm aware of that does this and does a really good job of it needs.
Because the longevity-based participation from a volunteer, not just a quick in and out kind of episodic approach. We're talking about a lifetime commitment. I mean, you literally changed your career path, the trajectory of your future, through an encounter that, you know, you shared about in our chapel that really brought you to a place of commitment here. So that's what we're talking about, right?
Yes.
Long-term stuff.
Absolutely. And the average lifespan of a volunteer is well beneath a year. Mm. This is a heavy space, and it's a difficult space to get into. And if you get into it because you think you are the solution, that load's too heavy to carry. If you get into it because you feel like this aligns with your heartbeat and the heartbeat of God, and that this way of bringing hope and healing and restoration is something you want to be a part of, then you walk into it as an instrument or a vessel so that love and peace and God's presence can flow through you. If this is something that you're coming in to save the world, your tenure is going to be very short.
Hmm. There's only one Savior, right?
Yeah, that's right. And he carried a heavy, heavy weight.
So Bob, I got a real deep probing question for you. It's real easy for somebody, it would be easy for me if I had to deal with this ugliness every day, to become jaded, to be agitated easily. You seem so calm, so caring. I know it's your nature. I know it's your call. I know who it is, what God's kind of put in you. Where do you turn? Is there a biblical passage? Is there an ideal in Scripture? What's the motivation for you to wake up every day? I mean, you got three awesome kids, man. You know,
yeah.
You have a holistic home. You and Melinda, a wonderful place, a safe place. How do you keep fighting this fight every day?
That's a great question. There are a couple of different ways that I look at it. One is that when we were contemplating making the transition and moving into this as a career, the questions that I asked myself were, what do I want to spend the last, you know, phase of my career doing? I'm 54. I don't think I'm about to shut everything down. But I'd sure like to leave a lasting impact and do something that was a little bit more. This fit that. I also was very careful in the standpoint that it's one of the rare times that I feel like I have specifically heard something that was from the Lord that was very helpful to me in my career. Now, that may just mean that I'm dense and I don't listen enough. Mm-hmm. But I feel very specifically that God said, I've called you to the battle, but I've not called you to carry the weight of the battle.
Mm.
I remind myself of that almost every day. And it's a very interesting concept because it allows me to feel like it's an honor to be a part of this. It's an honor to be representing Christ. It's an honor to be representing the kingdom in the work that we're doing. And I enjoy the ideal of putting Christ on display everywhere we go. But I don't have to carry the weight of it. And quite frankly, I'm incapable of carrying the weight of it. So I think that's the only way I'll have tenure. The other one is for us and for me, in conversations with Melinda, goes back to something that I said in chapel. And that was, once we encountered sex trafficking, and once we encountered and saw what it was, it changed something inside of me where I thought, I'm a good person to care about this.
Mm-hmm.
To, this is evil, and now I've seen it, and the only question left is, what am I going to do? And now that I've seen it, what do I want my kids, what do I want my family, what do I want my community to see my response to this being? That isn't the motivation behind it, but it's this idea of, too many times in life, I've seen a problem, and I've seen a crisis, and I was even moved by it. I may have even written a check, but I walked out, and I shook it off.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't last. And this was one of those things that stuck with me beyond the parking lot. And so it was not a difficult transition for us. I feel excited to be in it. I feel really honored to be able to be in it. There's a lot of difficult and heavy stuff in it, but every day there's another reason for hope as well. And we concentrate on the hope. That's mm-hmm. what we can move. That's what we can grow into and lean into. And that's where we can see people's lives changed. And every day we just, the hope gets compounded a little bit more. But it's real simple in this. I don't think this is about me. I think it's about Jesus Christ. And I think it's about his hope, his story, his message, and what he's trying to do here on earth.
Speaking of story, before we go, do you have a couple of stories, maybe of a victim, maybe of a trafficker that has been restored? And what does that look like?
Yeah, I think I would answer that by saying I have stories of people that are in the process of restoration. And that's one of the tragedies, and I'm not being limiting in any way, shape, or form. But for the most part, this is a lifelong process. These are scars and wounds that they heal, but they don't fully go away. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of a couple of folks that we work with now. One of them was a young lady who, on her 13th birthday, her father, who had already been molesting her, took her to a hotel room, invited a group of his friends to come with him, and then after they were through with her, put her in a dog crate and kept her there for an extended period of time, and then began to traffic her. I'm thinking of another lady that has been in our home and has been through restorative care and programs and is just doing a fantastic job herself, and she was molested when she was 7, and then she was molested again by another family member when she was 11, and she made the decision that she was not going to be vulnerable again. She would take control of the situation by never telling a boy no, a man no again. And so at 16, she was working in adult establishments and strip clubs. At 18, she was being trafficked. And then she went through a process and was rescued. And the neat part of her story, as it is with all of theirs, is at some point along the way, in almost every story of restoration that I know of, there is a defining encounter with Christ. It is somebody, and it may have been 13 people that planted the seed prior to the person that showed up, but there is this encounter with Christ when someone says, surely I was created for more than this. Mm. And it just begins a change and a trajectory where people begin to walk away. You can't for the most part go in and rescue and pull somebody out of this. We do it, and other organizations do it all the time. But that term rescue is probably a little misleading. It's compelling, but it's probably a little misleading. Most of the time, it is the response to a cry for help, and we respond to the cry. And when we respond to the cry and someone is ready to step out and get out, that's when you can see this pathway begin to take hold.
Bob, thank you for taking some time to sit with us today and just talk about this. One more time, if somebody wants to get involved with your organization, how do they do that?
Easiest way is the website, StreetGrace, StreetGrace, Grace, GRACE.org. We'd love to hear from them.
Take care. We appreciate it. And thank you for joining us on Servcast.
Thanks so much.
Be sure to rate and review us on iTunes and share us on Facebook. Hey, if you've got any questions, send them to servcast22@gmail.com. Thank you guys for tuning in. We'll see you next time on Servcast.
Thank you for listening to Servcast. The thoughts and opinions expressed on Servcast are those of William, Christian, their guests, and no one else. Tune in next time here on Servcast.